The next case on our calendar is 06-839, Ohio State Bar Association versus Brzezinski Brinkman et al. Mr. Welly.
Good morning, Chief Justice Moyer, Justice of the Supreme Court. There are essentially three issues, and I will be taking two issues, one dealing with the election issue that was found by the board. I will also be taking the negotiating of contracts that was found by the board. And Mr. Yund, who is amicus counsel for the Ohio Manufacturers Lawyers Association, will handle the preemption issue. Mr. Brzezinski, as the facts had demonstrated in the at the hearing, is a man who has been doing labor relations in the state of Ohio and other states for over 30 years. He counsels his clients with respect to election issues, and he helps his clients, his customers, negotiate labor contracts. He's been doing that for over 30 years. Testimony at the hearing by Mr. DeRose, who's licensed in Ohio, licensed in Florida as an attorney in labor matters, testified that beginning in 1962, this was the practice in the federal arena. It's the practice in many states in this country. It is the practice in the state of Ohio. Mr. Crow, who's a federal mediator, who has been mediating for the federal government, testified by affidavit that at mediation sessions where they're negotiating to put together a contract, there are business managers for the union who are negotiating on behalf of the union and writing language, and there are labor consultants on behalf of management who are doing precisely the same thing. James Wright, who is a vice president of human resources, by affidavit testified that he has had the same experience. Mr. Matheson, who is a testified as well by stipulation and by affidavit, is a Teamster. He was a Teamster most of his career. He negotiated contracts. He wrote contracts on behalf of Teamsters. He also entered a private business where he represented management in the crafting of labor agreements.
Is it true that, I think I read this in the brief, if Ohio finds this practice to be UPL, that we will be the first state in the country to do so?
Your Honor, that's true. That is the fact. The state of California permits it, the state of Iowa permits it, and the state of New Jersey permits it.
Are those the states only where the challenge has been brought, or has the challenge been brought in other states as well?
Those are the only three states that I'm aware of, Your Honor, where the challenge has been brought.
And all those courts ruled against the UPL charge.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. Now, the narrow two issues, one issue is very narrow, and I want to explain it to the court. In a labor situation, Mr. Brzezinski will be retained by a customer who wants a union not to be elected by the individuals. And he engages in what's known as persuader activity. And the brief has nine separate things that he does, and the panel found that one of the things that he does that is improper is that he counsels his customers with respect to election issues prior to the election. And I think that most of the things that are done in that circumstance or those circumstances are mundane and are not the practice of law. The things that are negotiated in those arenas are we going to have the election at the Ramada Inn or the Holiday Inn? How long are the polls going to be open? And I don't want to be disingenuous because there are some serious issues that come up, like, for example, who gets to vote, who's a supervisor, who may be an hourly employee, and who is eligible to vote.
Are those decisions determined by rules that have been adopted by the National Labor Relations Board, or do the parties have considerable discretion in deciding those, not the location and so forth, but who gets to vote and challenges to votes and that sort of thing?
They are determined, Your Honor, by the National Labor Relations regulations and by federal district court, court of appeals, and Supreme Court as to who gets to vote in those elections.
And so Brzezinski would be in that role would be simply explaining or enforcing, but explaining what the rule is and that we should comply with the rule. Is that?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. There is no practice of law. There is simply stating the rule that is very common in his industry.
Counsel, I read in the file that there is, in fact, information that is put out in, quote, layman's terms by the NLRB to assist employers, unions, whoever wants to receive this information on these various subjects.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There are.
They're not directed to legal counsel.
They are not directed to legal counsel. And I think one of the things that embraces this entire concept is this is a federal organization. The whole labor arena is a federal organization that Mr. Young will talk about. And these pamphlets are put out by the National Labor Relations Board for union people who are non-lawyers and who will be doing precisely what Mr. Brudinski is doing, and for management, so that you can understand in very clear language what you're permitted to do and what you're not permitted to do. And these pamphlets are available through the federal government. You can write for them, you can pick them up, and it's intended. This whole arena is intended, especially the pre-election in the election arena, is intended to be for non-lawyers. And so what he does in this first arena is, for the most part, to get the election completed. And if there's a dispute about who gets to vote, the management side simply says, we challenge that ballot. That's all you do. You challenge the ballot. And what's ironic about all of this is that once the ballot is challenged and there's a dispute about it, Mr. Brudinski, under the rules of the National Labor Relations Board, gets to go before the National Labor Relations Board and litigate that issue. He gets to call witnesses, he gets to direct witnesses, he gets to cross-examine witnesses. But what the panel found, and we believe erroneously, is that what he did in advance of that is the unauthorized practice of law, and we dispute that. The other thing that Mr. Brudinski does is he negotiates, on behalf of management, contracts. Sure sounds like the practice of law. But in the federal arena where they work, you sit at a table and sometimes have a federal mediator who is working with labor and management. Neither side has lawyers. The federal mediator may not be a lawyer, him or herself, and they hash together a contract that's significant. There's no question it's significant. It defines the rights of the parties. But it's, for the most part, about economic issues. And to your point, Justice O'Connor, what is permissible and what is required comes from the National Labor Relations Board. You must negotiate on this subject. It is permissible to negotiate on this subject. You may not negotiate on this subject. That's what they talk about. And so when you put together a labor contract, it's not like a merger and acquisition contract where there's lots of lawyers and accountants. You have financial people from the company who talk about the financial issues. They don't have to be lawyers. And then you put together, is it better to have 5 vacation days or 7? Or what's the disciplinary grievance procedure look like? Those are the things that are negotiated, and those are the things that are put in contract.
At that, contract negotiation sessions, I'm presuming that we're talking about labor, which is usually organized labor.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
And they're always represented by an attorney? Is
they
that
are
true?
Most, the record indicates that they are most often not represented by an attorney.
They're represented by a union member who has come up the ranks to be the union rep, right?
Well, the record indicated that, at least in the instance that we had, Mr. Matheson testified, he was a Marine, he had a GED, he worked for the Teamsters, he became the chief negotiator for the Teamsters in many contract negotiations.
And to your knowledge, has anybody from the unions been charged with the unauthorized practice of law?
Your Honor, it's been my understanding that no union member has been charged with the unauthorized practice of law. No person inside the company who negotiates has been charged with the unauthorized practice of law. And the record is clear that no person that Mr. Brudinski worked for in his 30 years has filed a complaint. There is nothing in the record of any labor negotiator who's had a complaint filed against him or her. And the record is that no labor union has had a complaint for the unauthorized, any complaint at all about the way they conduct themselves.
Counsel, would it be a fair characterization to indicate that on the employer side of the table, sometimes the representation is in-house employees, sometimes they're attorneys, sometimes they're not.
Absolutely right, Your Honor.
And if the representation is not an in-house employee, that often it would be an attorney or a law firm that would be employed to represent the company, and I assume sometimes it may be a combination of someone who provides this kind of service involved in trying to defeat the election of a union, together with lawyers sitting at the table hammering out the contract.
Your Honor, that's precisely what the facts are in this case. Mr. Brodinski made it very clear that when he talks initially to his customers, he tells them, I am not a lawyer. If you have corporate counsel, you have private counsel, I would be happy to meet with them, and we can put together this strategy with your local, with your counsel. If there comes a point in the negotiations or in the pre-election or in the election process where Mr. Brodinski believes that a lawyer is necessary, he encourages his clients, the record was crystal clear on that, he encourages his clients, get counsel. I am not a lawyer. I know how to do this, but if it gets beyond this, you'll need counsel.
Mr. Welly, the representation has been made. I think it was a finding by the report from the board that your client has drafted collective bargaining agreements, which he has negotiated, or which he and his wife have negotiated. Now, when we get into the drafting of a collective bargaining agreement, do we get into the practice of law?
Well, Your Honor, the answer is we do not believe that that is the practice of law.
The negotiation of or the preparation of a collective bargaining agreement following a negotiation is not the practice of law, in your view.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we believe that there's really three positions. The first position is it is not the practice of law because of the arena they're practicing in and the way that it is done. It is done by using...
Do we run the risk then of having real estate agents prepare real estate contracts?
Well, I think that...
I mean, what we have to do here, you understand, is look at a field or an arena, as you point out, but then find out where or whatever determination we reach might have some impact around our state.
Your Honor, I think that that's a very valid point, and we don't dismiss that as being a valid point. But I think that we have to see it in the arena in which it occurs, and it's the federal arena. And the federal arena permits this kind of activity. And it is a culmination of people sitting at a table in the classic smoke-filled room where people are suggesting language to contracts, and then somebody, it could be the human resources vice president of the company, or it could be the manager or the business manager for the union, who actually completes the final draft. But there's no question, Mr. Brodinski, and I think the record, Your Honor, is clear that his wife was not a lead negotiator, but she did sit at the table and suggest the language. But
I think the problem I'm having is that your client is acting in a representative capacity on behalf of a corporation. And I think, as Justice Pfeiffer pointed out, there may be labor negotiators acting in a representative capacity on behalf of a labor union. And I don't know that the record reflects, I haven't gone through it thoroughly enough to see if they perhaps draft collective bargaining agreements as well. But my point is, as I recollect what we've done with the workers' compensation area, a certain portion of the work done there by non-lawyers didn't constitute the practice of law, but other things that might engage the practice of law were prohibited. I'm wondering if there might be some similar kind of line that needs to get drawn.
Your Honor, and I appreciate that, but I believe that what Mr. Brodinski is doing, first of all, is not the practice of law, and that's a conclusion, but I also believe that public policy would allow this court to say that in that arena, what Mr. Brodinski does and what the business managers do on behalf of the unions do is appropriate, because that's how the system has worked for years, without complaint. So I think the court can either find that it is the practice of law, it is not the practice of law, and allow it, or find that, yes, it may be the practice of law, but permit it because it is something that has worked, and the public is not injured by it. In fact, the public is advanced by it. By virtue of the fact that there have been no complaints, by virtue of the fact that we don't have a victim, by virtue of the fact...
How did this case come to the attention of the Ohio State Bar?
Well, Your Honor, none of this is in the record, but I'd certainly be happy to indulge you with that. Mr. Burdensky belonged to a condominium complex in the state of South Carolina. And Common Pleas Judge John Petzl from Montgomery County has a condominium or had a condominium in the same complex. Mr. Burdensky was running for the board of the condominium complex, and he left and sent to the members who owned condominiums there his qualifications. Judge Petzl believed that he was engaging in the unauthorized practice of law, and that's the genesis of complaints.
Counsel, following up what Justice O'Donnell was probing, and I think I had the same curiosity. While I was not in the majority in the workers' comp area, the court followed sort of down the track that you're arguing. Well, this has been tradition, so let it alone. But then the court drew a very definite line regarding cross-examination and certain matters that if you did that, that was clearly the practice of law. And folks who are not attorneys would not be permitted to engage in certain specific conduct. The argument that you seem to be advancing is it's all off limits in terms of court regulation as practice of law. Anything that this man does is not the practice of law that he does in this labor negotiation, including drafting the final contract. You're not stopping with, well, these are the points the employer wants and these are the points the union wants, and we can all shake hands on that. Just as the comparison was made to a real estate deal. People sit down and they go, yeah, you know, now the lawyers will draw up the contract or draw up the final version, and there'll be some language that nobody ever saw before and wasn't discussed at the table, but it's because that's what you do in a real estate transaction, for example, and it would seem the same would be appropriate in a labor negotiation or a collective bargaining agreement or any of those things. So isn't there a point in which your client should say, okay, this is, we've got everything but putting a ribbon on it, but the lawyer needs to step in at this point and to make sure and do the final draft of the document?
Your Honor, I think not. And I think that there are lots of distinctions, and I'm running out of time, but there are lots of distinctions. For example, lawyers are not involved in the final crafting of a real estate contract. Sometimes they are, but in the ordinary residential contract, it's a form. You fill out the form, you initial what you change. No lawyer sees that, by and large. No lawyer goes to the closing, and there's no harm done by it. And what happens in this arena is it's been going on since the National Labor Relations Act was enacted. Lawyers typically are on neither side of the negotiations. Lawyers are typically not crafting the final language. And the reason is that the team...
I thought we agreed that lawyers typically may be. It's at the option of the employer.
So certainly at the option of the employer.
I mean, you seem to say this is a field in which lawyers don't... No. Don't travel at all. That would not be true. I assume we have a number of folks in your own firm who make a good living off of this kind of work.
And Mr. Yund, who will speak on the preemption issue, does precisely that. And I'm not suggesting that at all, but I'm suggesting in a lot of circumstances, especially in small business circumstances, that this whole process can be done effectively, efficiently, without violation of public policy, by people who are not lawyers, both on the union side and on the employer side. It's been going on since the 30s and 40s without a problem, without a complaint to this court. Your Honor, I would like to, if there are more questions, I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal, if I may.
But you said Mr. Yund wants to speak to the preemption issue. I do want to ask, I do have some questions about the preemption issue, but was he planning to do that on rebuttal? Because you've used you're well beyond your time, as you know.
I understand. He can do that on rebuttal then.
All right. Okay. Yep. Thank you, Mr. Welly. Mr. Robinson.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, and members of the Supreme Court, Learned Counsel. I'm Ian Robinson, Salem, Ohio, and with me is Gene Wetzel from the Ohio State Bar Association, Columbus, Ohio. We represent the relator. In this case, what Mr. Berdzinski, his spouse, and his corporation did is clearly the practice of law and should be controlled by this court. There are 70 years of history from precedents out of this court that have clearly said that putting down or creating legal instruments that protect and create the legal rights and duties of other people is the practice of law. And if you change that rule to carve out an exception for Mr. Berdzinski, the exceptions are going to end up swallowing that rule, diluting the confidence of the public in people.
But we already had a case in which we found that real estate agents were permitted to complete a contract in
that
real estate transactions.
Justice Lundberg Stratton, that is correct. I believe real estate brokers are allowed to fill in the blanks and check boxes on a contract. However, it is like on the other side that real estate brokers, banks, and other people who are not directly parties to the transaction may not prepare deeds. A deed can be as simple as a one-page instrument if you use the statutory form. That's a far cry different from Relator's Exhibit 11, a 50-page written agreement that includes all kinds of legal concepts, terms that perhaps Mr. Berdzinski and other people like him would
not
understand.
Well, there's a lot of case law out there that talks about allowing what is technically the practice of law on the basis of public policy. There's quite a few cases out there on that issue. What is the public policy reason for changing and being, if it's true, the only state to change this practice? What is the public policy need? What is the harm that seems to be emerging that we should change decades of tradition?
Justice Stratton, there are decades of tradition that drafting contracts and negotiating contracts is the practice of law. In the cases that the justice is referring to, take for example Comp Management 1. There, the court hung its decision on the fact that the Industrial Commission had a resolution that permitted laypersons to appear before the commission.
But that's not exactly my question. There's several other states that have found public policy permits. If you want to call this the practice, let's concede this is the practice of law, but public policy permits it. What is the harm that you are trying to reach at that we need to correct by changing this practice?
Some states do permit that. California, I believe, and one of the other Western states has done it by rule or regulation that permits non-lawyers to engage in certain conduct. New Jersey did it by case law, apparently, in 1948. So of the three states where it is allowed, that's not to say that no other states have done. What is the public harm? The public is harmed in several ways. First, Congress itself found in this area that the practitioners were involved in graft, corruption, and misleading practices that was harmful to the labor policy of the United States. Second, you are dealing in many ways with serious matters.
What year was that?
That would be sometime in the 60s. It's tied with that. Remember the persuader activity?
Right.
So there's some history. Some time has passed before
that. Is there current history of that?
Yes, there is. Right in the record of this case, Mr. Matheson, for example, the expert, was frequently known to switch sides on the same bargaining contract, something a lawyer would never be able to do because of the conflict of interest. Mr. Matheson, when he didn't control his temper, was known to throw bricks at people who disagreed with him. There is a Mr. Matheson purchased out the employees' contracts that when he was supposed to be representing the employees, and turned around to own those employees that he could lease them back to the company. There are obvious dangers, not the least of which is the ability of people's lives to be affected by the terms of the contract. Even the placement of a single comma can make a critical difference. What other harm exists to the public? Take, for example, why does this court set the bar so high when it comes to admission to the practice of law? And the short answer is to protect the public. That's why we have 4 years of college, 3 years of law school, a test that tests our knowledge of legal matters, continuing legal education, a character and fitness evaluation, as well as lots of training and assistance from people older than us who are mentoring us along. Here, you don't have any of those things. There is no admission requirement for labor consultants. There is no body that sets a course of ethics or other standards. There is no minimum educational requirements. You can just open up your door, like Mr. Berdzinski, operate out of his home and become a labor consultant. You would think that one would get what they pay for.
Mr. Robinson, you argue persuasively, but there's no complaint of any of this activity contained in our record, to my knowledge.
I'm not sure what you are referring to, Justice O'Donnell. There was a complaint about Mr. Berdzinski preparing this contract, negotiating the labor agreement. And
by a client or a participant or by Judge Petzl?
If you order me, Your Honor, I will disclose how we got it, but ordinarily the deliberations and reasons behind the decision-making of the Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee are confidential. Another benefit to the public when the public involves a lawyer. But as this complaint came to us, one of the first things we noticed in Mr. Berdzinski's literature is he states, "I will help you with your legal problems." That's what caught our eye. I will help you.
I guess my point is, any of the persons for whom Mr. Berdzinski has worked or his firm has worked have not complained about any of his activities or lack of diligence or excessive fees or nor are those who are presumably negotiating with him or with his firm complaining about some errant tactic having been engaged in. That's what I had reference to when I said that record didn't seem to contain any complaints, and that's what I wanted you to address.
That's a very good question, Justice O'Donnell.
Thank you for asking. I get one once
here,
in a while.
Yeah, I'm sure you get a lot. Here, there may well be customers or clients who were very satisfied. A person who was not a lawyer, take a title agent, could very well draft a deed and do it correctly. Mr. Dada, in the Alexicole case, could very well have been a very skilled securities arbitration negotiator, an area that arises usually under federal law. He could well have done a very good job in preparing that. In the
Justice Martin. I've got an issue that I think maybe is on the point of the order of the our board is recommending to us that we tell Mr. Berdzinski and others to stop doing three things, as I see in the order: stop drafting the collective bargaining agreements and stop being the lead negotiator. And then the third one is to stop negotiating the settlement of election issues. Let's take that one first. That one seems to me to be really on the edge.
It's not as serious as drafting a 50-page labor agreement. However, as my learned counsel stated, there can be some serious issues. Who gets to vote? How will they vote?
But if the rules are set by the National Labor Relations Act as to who gets, are there gray areas? I mean, are there that a lawyer needs to determine, or is it set out pretty much in the regulations, you look at the regulation and somebody decides, well, you can vote and you cannot vote.
Well, actually, it's not in the regulations. It's decided by case law. And it's the lawyer's skill, judgment, training, experience that allows the lawyer to read the cases, to understand what the case law means, to apply an analysis and interpretation to the case law and predict the outcome.
And counsel, if there's a disagreement as to that, who's going to vote, et cetera, where does that disagreement get resolved?
It could be possible that a federal mediator would then be involved in helping to resolve the disputed areas.
In fact, most of the, if they can't be resolved through a mediator or internally, where do they go from there? The NLRB?
The National Labor Relations Board could.
Which permits Mr. Budzinski, or Budzinski, excuse me, to appear, to question, to represent.
Yes, there is a specific regulation that permits lay people to appear and represent people when they are conducting proceedings before the National Labor Relations Board, Justice O'Connor.
Then what you're stating, though, then anything that is preliminary to getting to the National Labor Relations Board has to have an attorney involved, and yet when you get to the big time, you know, the NLRB hearing, you don't need an attorney.
That is certainly a case, as you have
stated.
Seems
a little incongruous, doesn't it?
It may be incongruous, but that's exactly why Congress has the ability to clarify that if they want. Or the National Labor Relations Board, like the Industrial Commission in Ohio, could issue a regulation that permits that. But in the absence of a regulation, there is no preemption. There is no preemption because there's no statute or rule like there was in your comp management case, or no regulation like there was in your Hines versus Giles case. Here, there is an absence of effort by Congress or the National Labor Relations Board to say that it can be done. And in the absence of that regulation, Ohio's public policy, expressed through the decisions in Dworkin and the other 70 years of history, leading right up through 2005, 2006, that drafting legal instruments that affect the rights of other people is the practice of law. And if you start eating away at that, you're going to erode the system. And the public will be harmed because they will not have the foresight, the knowledge, the ability, the skill, and the judgment that brings to bear upon matters like that. And I'd suggest to you that even if something as simple as apparently simple as a real estate deed is going to cause problems for the public when non-qualified people are doing it, so too will a labor agreement, 50 pages in depth, that gets very complicated. Additionally, Justice O'Connor, when you go to the National Labor Relations Board, the issue tends to be very narrow. Was there a violation of Section 7? Was there a violation of Section 8? However, when you are negotiating a labor agreement, you're touching upon not only wages, hours, benefits, discrimination issues, disciplinary issues, the right to hire and fire, and other things.
So if you, if we would uphold and agree that it's the unauthorized practice of law to participate in the negotiation and drafting of a contract, an agreement between the unions and management, then presumably the unions will not be allowed to be represented by their union reps. Is that correct?
That is not correct, Justice O'Connor.
What's the difference?
The difference is this. Just like in the Allstate case before the Board of the Unauthorized Practice of Law, in that case, Allstate was seen to have a pro se pecuniary interest. Likewise, the employer who represents himself, the labor union that either through its local or its national sends an employee down, an employee of that bargaining unit or an employee of the labor union that is a signer to that contract, they have a direct pecuniary interest that is going to be affected. So the Bar Association specifically, and it's in the opening statement as of the proceedings as to where we were going, we do not seek to limit labor unions or corporations from self-help.
That's what I was going to ask, that if instead of having Mr. Brzezinski representing the corporation, that it was a member of the corporation representing themselves. Would you find that to be unauthorized practice of law?
I would not find that to be the unauthorized practice of law, they're doing it in their own self-interest.
Okay.
So that does not bar the corporation.
Then how do you square that with the statute that says that a corporation has to have an attorney and cannot represent itself?
There is a statute that says a corporation cannot represent itself in court. And of course, this court has recognized that, with the small exception in the Perlman case, that in certain small claims cases where the owner is a 100% or near majority owner of the corporation, the LLC, that he could do that. In my 15 seconds that I have left, I'd like to urge that this court uphold the long standards of the 70 years of history that have abolished the practice of law by laypersons when it comes to drafting agreements. There is no federal preemption. In fact, in my brief, there are at least two cases of the United States Supreme Court that say that the states have a serious interest in regulating the practice of law.
Well, yeah, in fact, that's the question I wanted to ask, and I'll ask it of you before Mr. Young has a chance to respond to it, is that you don't make the argument that the federal cases do not include, I don't see any federal cases here involving the authority of a state Supreme Court. We have constitutional authority
Article
to regulate
4.
The practice of law. The cases seem to be a state statute or not the state constitution. Is that not an argument for you on the
yes.
preemption issue?
In the California or out west cases, there was a statute, but here in Ohio, Article 4 of the Constitution allows this court exclusive jurisdiction over the practice of law. That, by the way, is why that West Coast case is worthless.
Well, that's my point. You didn't argue in your brief that the preemption doesn't apply against, and maybe it does, but I don't know of any cases that say that an act of Congress or a regulation by a federal agency supersedes the constitutional authority of a state.
I didn't argue that, and I don't have that depth of experience that you do, Your Honor, but may I point out that when the ability of a state to regulate who will be the bargaining representative came before the United States Supreme Court in two instances. One is the Brown versus Hotel Employees on page 20, 23, 24 of my brief. There, New Jersey prohibited anybody convicted of a felony from being a union bargaining representative. Here we have a company bargaining representative. The United States Supreme Court said it's a matter of great state interest. Furthermore, it did not interfere with the Garmin preemption doctrine, and it was not an economic weapon of the sort involved in the Machinist versus Wisconsin. So that's a green light. The second case that was a little older I cited was the New York waterfront case, where once again a felon was prohibited from being a union officer. The United States Supreme Court said that's a fine thing for the state to do. It's in the public interest to manage who is going to be in charge of things like that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr.
for your
Robinson.
Time.
Mr. Yund, you may take a minute. You've used your time, but take a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is George Yund, and I'm here on behalf of the Ohio Management Lawyers Association, not the Manufacturers Association. I'm here pro bono.
There's a difference?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. We are a group of experienced management side labor lawyers who took a look at your docket and concluded we might have something to add, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, but let me start by reinforcing a couple things that have already been alluded to. Number one, it is inconsistent for the Bar Association to take the position that you cannot represent someone in the context of the negotiations over election details, that if you're unsuccessful in those negotiations, we'll end up in a hearing where the National Labor Relations Board has expressly ruled that you can represent and not be a lawyer. And so that's point one. Point two is that this case will affect not just employers and not just labor consultants, but will also affect or potentially affect unions. Because if you rule that it is the practice of law, and it is the unauthorized practice of law, to be involved in drafting labor agreements, the first thing I'm going to do when I'm representing an employer is look to see who my adversary is. Now, usually, it's a business agent or an international representative of an international union. Sometimes the international union is a party to the collective bargaining agreement and a party to the negotiations. Very often, however, as detailed at least in the Rosenthal affidavit, which is part of the record, the international representative, which is a paid employee of the international union, is not representing a party to the collective bargaining agreement. They're in exactly the same position in terms of consultancy that Mr. Brodzinski is in this case. And so the shoe's going to fit both feet is the point I'm trying to make.
Well, counsel, there's at least some suggestion from our back and forth here that it's one thing to have non-attorneys in the smoke-filled room banging back and forth over the details. It's another thing to have a non-lawyer do the final draft of the terms, the essential terms that are agreed to in that smoke-filled room.
Well, Your Honor, the difference, I respectfully submit, in collective bargaining is that that big, thick contract is a product of committee negotiation. You have members of the bargaining unit on one side of the table, along with the local union representative or officers and the international union representative. You have, very often, me or my counterparts, lawyers, sometimes Mr. Brodzinski, the Vice President of Industrial Relations, and a number of managers on the other side, and they all debate this language, and you don't sit down at the end and draft a final contract embodying these principles. Rather, you negotiate every single item of that language in that contract. And so by the end of the process, you have lots of committee input and lots of agreement, pieces of paper that have tentative agreement initialed on them by both sides. And so it's not, as it has been portrayed, a process where the parties debate what the contract should say, and then it gets turned over to Mr. Brodzinski or a lawyer to draft the final product.
No, I think it works. Understand that he's in the room, and people without legal training obviously can learn to do a number of these things and probably do them very well for employers. The question becomes, though, before there's a final document, shouldn't a lawyer be involved?
Well, I think you're right. That's exactly the point. The issue is this court has admitted that there are occasions in which it is not in the public interest to have lawyers involved in, for example, workers' comp cases and other kinds of cases where you've recognized that something that touches legal activity may look like activity on some occasions may be handled by a lawyer. It's not in the public interest for this court to say that it always must be handled by a lawyer.
It's this beyond is one of those our role here is to determine what is it that constitutes the practice of law in the state of Ohio, because that's what we're regulating. We really don't care who's in the room. Our definition needs to come in clarifying for the public and the labor community, management or union, what is it that constitutes the practice of law? And the simple question I think that Justice Pfeiffer is getting to is, does the drafting of a collective bargaining agreement constitute the practice of law in your view, yes or no? That's the issue.
Sometimes it does. I'm afraid I cannot answer that question and answer it honestly, yes or no, because I know the way collective bargaining agreements get drafted, and it's not a process of turning over notes or having somebody sit there and then determine how the agreement should be embodied in writing, unlike other aspects
of law. So to go back to what the Chief pointed out, we have the drafting of a collective bargaining agreement. We have a negotiator during this process of negotiating the agreement. And then we have this role of lead negotiator, which are really the three elements that we are supposed to ferret through to figure out which of those approximates the practice of law and which of those can be left to members of the public. And the hurdle I'm trying to get across is, how do we let individuals act in a representative capacity on behalf of others who aren't lawyers to write a collective bargaining agreement which affects the lives of thousands of people?
Well, my only answer I can give to that is that you examine whether or not it's in the, whether or not the consumers that you're looking at of legal services are in a position where they are capable of being abused if you allow anyone who the consumer selects to participate in those roles. And I respectfully submit, as much as I like to be hired by consumers of legal services, that you do not need to do anything different than the 49 other states have done and just leave this whole area alone and leave it up to the consumer to decide that I either want a lawyer or I don't want a lawyer.
Thank you.
Counsel, in your years of working in this area, have you found the use of these representatives to be a problem? Have you found their quality, their ability to handle the negotiations, their experience level to be an issue for you? Because I noticed you filed your amicus on their behalf.
Yes. Not generally, Your Honor. That as with some lawyers, you know, it depends. And I believe it's up to the businessman to determine whether or not he wants to pay for the services of a lawyer in this area or pay for the services of a labor consultant. But in general, the answer to your question is no, I have not found that they have been a problem in the areas that we are being asked to address.
Counsel, I was going to say, who handles the discipline or who takes care of the oversight of these independent consultants if they are not members of the bar?
The marketplace, Your Honor. If they do not do their job, if they flip-flop, if there's some, and I've never seen this, but I know it's in the record that there was one individual who did most of his work for the Teamsters who somehow showed up on the other side consulting with management. I've never seen that happen, but I respectfully submit that it is unlikely that an employer is going to hire somebody who has been on the other side, because employers, clients in this area tend to go with people who are either management side or union side. And that brings me to my last point, which
well,
is
preemption. Before you get to your last
yes.
point, I have
yes,
a question.
Your Honor.
I mean, practically and typically speaking, you have representatives from the management side and the union side sitting at a table, probably with the copies of the previous contract. They go through it step by step. Maybe there's a representation to begin with that we have three areas to negotiate, might be vacation, might be pension, and it might be insurance.
Always wages.
Or wages, yeah. Whatever. And so you've got to sit down and literally handwrite between the parties, this is what we want here, this is what we can't deal with, and I imagine that the various sentences then are cobbled together from both sides and then reduced to a writing that is then eventually signed by both sides. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's the way
how
it works.
It's not where the representative comes in with a 50-page document and said, here's the contract that I have drafted for you to present and have signed by the union, Mr. Employer.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
The process of good faith bargaining under Section 8A5 of the National Labor Relations Act requires that very give and take, as opposed to somebody coming in and laying down the last best offer.
On the other hand, don't the committees usually then look to the attorney to make sure that whatever is stated in a legal fashion?
Not in my experience, Your Honor. What happens is when the lawyer's involved at the table, the lawyer gives input in caucuses to his side about the effect that some language might have in a given circumstance, but also the supervisor who has to administer that contract on a day-to-day basis has as much input about the practicality of that language as the lawyer does about any possible legality. And I'm suggesting that works just fine. It's worked just fine in the other states. And I'm also, to make that last point on preemption, suggesting that if you limit by regulation the number and type of people who can be involved in this process on both sides, by limiting, you are necessarily affecting the economics of the process, because if you limit supply, obviously that has an impact on price. That's the free play of economic forces. That's part of the free play of economic forces.
Should we keep Joe Blow from drafting wills and trusts and anything else? I mean, we can drive the cost of all kinds of legal services
Well, that's
right into the basement.
I have a great answer for that, Your Honor, and that is that the Congress of the United States has not chosen to impose a uniform system of regulation of the drafting of wills. By contrast, it has chosen through the National Labor Relations Act, the Labor Management Relations Disclosure Act, to impose a comprehensive uniform federal system, and said as part of that, in the machinist case, that any attempt at state regulation is preempted to the extent there's a potential, even a potential conflict with the free play of economic forces that Congress has chosen through the National Labor Relations Act and this whole federal scheme to leave to the marketplace. So that's why the will example is different from the federal labor
example. That's an awfully broad interpretation of the preemption doctrine.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at that Brown versus Hotel Employees Local 54 case that my opponent cited to you and spent a lot of time briefing, you'll find that it is a very broad principle. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said in that case that there's a presumption in favor of preemption by this federal regulatory scheme, and the only reason they didn't find the state of New Jersey's regulation against having a criminal background and being involved in a union that represents casino workers is because she found that, or the court found, that Congress had done the very same thing in the Labor Management Relations Disclosure Act. This is at 468 U.S. 505 of that decision. She said the reason why it wasn't preempted is because it was entirely consistent with Congress's own effort to prevent organized crime from being involved in the representation of employees.
Thank you, Mr. Yund.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.